Welcome to Author Stories, the podcast where we talk to the best writers in the industry and discuss writing and the creative process. Whether you are a writer, a reader, or both, we hope you'll find something here that makes you love books and the writers that create them. You can find archives of all of the great conversations I've had with authors over the years at hankgarner.com. Take some time and browse around there. I'm sure you'll find a new author to love, find inspiration for your own creative life, and find a new story to get lost in. My guest today is Tracy Chevalier. We're talking about her new historical fiction book, A Single Thread. This is a really great conversation that we had. If you're interested in historical fiction at all, there's something in here that you're going to love. Before we talk to Tracy, let's thank some sponsors. Jasper T. Scott. His box set, Dark Space, the complete series. This is 6 books bundled together, on sale now for 99 cents. 6 complete books, over 600,000 copies sold. More than 2,000 pages of epic space opera for the low price of 99 cents. Also available in Kindle Unlimited if you're a Kindle Unlimited subscriber. Humanity is defeated. 10 years ago, the Scythians invaded the galaxy with one goal: to wipe out the human race. Now the survivors are hiding in the last human sector of the galaxy, Dark Space, once a place of exile for criminals, now the last refuge of mankind. The once galaxy-spanning Imperium of Star Systems is left guarding the gate, which is the only way in or out of Dark Space, but not everyone is satisfied with their governance. Freelancer and ex-convict Ethan Ortain is on the run. He owes crime lord Alec Barandi 10,000 souls, and his ship is badly damaged. When Barandi catches up with him, he makes an offer Ethan can't refuse. Ethan must infiltrate and sabotage the Valiant, the Imperial Star System's fleet carrier which stands guarding the entrance of Dark Space, and then his debt will be cleared. While Ethan is still undecided about what he'll do, he realizes that the Imperium has been lying and putting all of Dark Space at risk. Now Brondi's plan is starting to look like a necessary evil, but before Ethan can act on it, he discovers that the real plan was much more sinister than what he was told, and he will be lucky to escape the Valiant alive. Grab all 6 books for 99 cents right now. Dark Space, the complete series by Jasper T. Scott. The Unwelcome Trilogy by R.D. Brady. Survivor, Mother, Leader, and Humanity's Last Chance. Deep within the remnants of the United States, Lila Richards oversees a camp of 200 survivors. In a world where living is an everyday struggle, and only through banding together can people survive, the arrival of the unwelcome only made her job harder. Riley Quinn and Miles Jones have been raised by Lila for the last 5 years. They're also one of the cursed, the children between the ages of 13 and 18, whom the unwelcome kill on sight. No questions, no pleas, just death. Protecting one another and the people of their camp is ingrained in all of them. But now each of them faces increased danger as the reason why the cursed have been targeted by the unwelcome slowly comes to light. And that truth will shock them to their core. Now time is running out, not just for the cursed who are being hunted down by the unwelcome, not just for Lila and her family who will face the greatest challenge yet, but for all of humanity. The world changed radically 35 years ago, but today humanity's very existence is on the line, and the fight has begun that will ensure its future or its annihilation. Fans of A.G. Riddle, James Rollins, Suzanne Collins, and Brandon Sanderson will love the Unwelcome Trilogy. Pick up your copy of the Unwelcome Trilogy on Amazon today. Edge of Valor, a military sci-fi thriller by Josh Hayes. When their mission fails, his begins. David Weber calls it a tour de force. Special Agent Jackson Fisher is a man after truth. When a military operation to extract a high-ranking ambassador from the war-torn border world of Stonemire ends in disaster, Fisher is called in to investigate. A whole platoon went in, but only 3 Alliance Marines returned home, the rest killed in action along with hundreds of civilians. With tensions between the Holloman Alliance and Stonemire rising, Fisher attempts to stitch the pieces together. One thing becomes more and more certain: the surviving Marines are lying. As the truth unfurls, Fisher begins to realize this was far more than a simple rescue mission, and that the truth might be something best left buried. Filled with action, mystery, and well-crafted characters, Edge of Valor, the Valor series book one, will put you into a world of war, conspiracy, and betrayal. It's perfect for fans of David Weber's Honorverse or Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan with a futuristic flair. That's Edge of Valor by Josh Hayes. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Tracy Chevalier on the show with me today. She has a fantastic new book called A Single Thread, and if you've read any of her other books, you know that you're in for a treat when a new book of hers comes out. Welcome to the show, Tracy.
Thank you for having me.
I'm excited to have you. Tracy, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Oh, good question. I've loved books for as long as I can remember, and there wasn't a single moment, but all my childhood, I read so many books, I just knew I wanted to be involved with them in some way. So I do remember thinking that I wanted to be either a librarian or a writer. I didn't mind either. You know, it could have been either, but it was right. Just I wanted to be in on the ground with the books, and the library was where I got mine from. So that was either one or the other.
I love that. Were you a bookish kid?
Oh, yeah. I used to go to the library every week, and I would get a stack of books and take them home and read them. Just lie on my bed and read them, and then I'd go back the next week. And the children's librarian there, Mrs. Carney, she knew me well, and she would set aside a book for me every time, and a special book. And she'd always remember what she had given me. And then when I came back, when I brought it back, she'd ask me what I thought of it, and we'd talk about it. And then she'd say, oh, I think you might be old enough for this. Let's try it. And she always made, you know, she pushed me to try different things. And it was really, she was great. I think everybody should have a Mrs. Carney in their lives.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Did you have anyone other than Mrs. Carney who recognized this love of books in you? Did you ever have an adult in your life, maybe a parent, maybe a teacher, who recognized the storytelling gift in you?
Well, yeah, actually, I had a high school teacher who I was on. There was a literary magazine at my high school, and I was on the staff of it. And then I became the editor-in-chief my senior year. And the advisor for that group, she always knew that I wanted to. She wanted to write. And I remember her telling me that she sent stories to the New Yorker and magazine and elsewhere, and she'd get back her rejection letters, and she'd put them up on our wall and throw darts at them. And and I think she knew that I had the bug as well. So she was very encouraging.
I heard you say once about growing up in Washington, D.C., that it's a very strange place to visit if you're not into politics. I know that you now live in England, with your family. How do you feel like those two places, the place you were born and raised, and now the place where you live, affect the way you see the world and the way you tell stories?
Well, my dad was a photographer for the Washington Post, so he kind of viewed the whole city, as what was going on in Washington, as one big story. So he would come home from work and we'd say, what stories did you cover today? So it all was about storytelling. I mean, for him, it was telling stories with pictures, but it was still storytelling. So I think that probably imprinted on me a little bit. I think the other thing is that Washington is a very transient place. I mean, that's why it's weird to grow up there, because most people don't actually grow up there. They come from somewhere else and move there for a few years, and then they move on, or they, you know, they don't actually, they aren't kids, they don't have their childhood there. So it's, and there's no other industry, like there's no big industry that you can say, well, Pittsburgh is a steel town, or you know, Houston's an oil town, but D.C. is a government town. That's what they do there, and there are no factories. So it's a strange not to, you know, if you're not in government, then what do you do? You're still affected by it. Everybody's talking about government all the time at parties, and it's just I found it kind of odd. You know, and when I go back there, I was just back there recently for a book tour, and I still love going, and I have friends there, and but it is all about politics there, so it's hard for anything else to get a look in. Now, London, on the other hand, is, you know, there's everything here, and it for me as an American here, I mean, I've lived here over 30 years, and I sort of feel like it's I'm not a native English person. But then most people aren't in London. We're from all over the place. So it's such a melting pot that I feel like I get a little bit of everything here. And that makes it really exciting and different for me.
You worked for a time, and please correct me if I'm wrong, as an editor on reference books. Did having that job scratch part of that itch that you had, that where you said you always wanted to work around books, either writing or as a librarian? Did working as an editor, how did that fit into what you felt like was going to be your destination?
It did fit in for a while. It was, I think, as I grew older, when I went to college, I discovered this thing called publishing, which I didn't really know anything about as a kid. You know, as a kid, you just think the books appear. Who knows
right.
how they get made?
right.
And so the librarian is way more important than the publisher, because the librarian is the source of the books. But
right.
actually, the source of the books is the author. But then they give birth. You know, the midwife is the publisher. And I thought, I could go into publishing. And being an editor was great for a while. And as it happened, the reference books were about writers, so I was still in that world. But after a few years, I mean, and the great thing, I'm incredibly grateful for that job, because I had to do a lot of research on, you know, say I do an encyclopedia of contemporary poets. I had to put together a biobibliography of them and commission an essay about them. And I got to know really well how to do research effectively and accurately. And that was a great boon to me as a historical novelist, you know, finding my way around libraries and resources and such. And the other thing is that so much about writing is editing, like self-editing and also being edited. And because I was an editor, I was like on the other side, and I used to help people make their essays about writers better. And I learned how to turn a good sentence into a great sentence. And, you know, it's other people's writing, though. But I knew how to handle them. I learned how to handle them and how to make suggestions tactfully and what to look for and how to make writing tighter and better. So that was all a great training ground. But eventually I got tired of working on other people's words, and I wanted to work on my own. And that was when I'd started writing short stories on the side at night, at weekends, and as well as an editor. And I thought, maybe I could do this, you know, go into this. Maybe I need to spend more time on my own work. And I ended up doing an MA in creative writing for a year, and that was like taking a sidestep away from the life I had and really focusing on my own writing for a year. And I think that changed everything.
Working as an historical novelist, like you mentioned, there are historical novels that deal with the framework of a specific time and maybe loosely around an historical event that most of us are familiar with. You tend to really bore down with your focus to a particular person, or you get a very close view and then tell a fictional story around someone that we might could actually do some research on and find out actual things about this person. Do you distinguish between the kinds of work that you do and maybe people that tell these big sweeping epics and make up all the characters, but they might be loosely based around an historical event.
Yeah, I tend to go for the little guys, the stories of ordinary people maybe doing something extraordinary. I don't focus on the battles and the kings and the queens and the sort of more obvious stuff. I tend to go at it sideways. It's like a sideways view of history a little bit. And I think it makes it, it makes it maybe more accessible, or it's just a different approach. And I'm certainly not opposed to, I like a Hilary Mantel historical novel about Henry VIII and Thomas Cromwell as much as anybody else. But I also recognize that there are ways of telling that story or the story of the time through different points of view of people maybe who have not had a voice or an opportunity to tell their story. And so my books are kind of sprinkled with people who, there are some real people in them, and they're often mixed up with people who I've made up. And I try to weave that fact and fiction together. But it's almost always of something that you wouldn't necessarily expect. So it might be about a fossil hunter or cushions and kneelers in Winchester Cathedral. I mean, that's pretty esoteric. So I just have to trust the right reader to follow me into these more unusual roadways of history.
Do you remember what it was that sparked your imagination about historical fiction and about the kinds of stories that that are anchored in real life and real history?
Well, it started really with my first novel, which was about a contemporary novel that had historical elements in it. And it was about a woman, an American woman who moves to France and it starts researching her family history. And this coincided with me looking into my own family history. And Chevalier is a French Huguenot name. And the story of our family apparently is that we came from a certain part of southern France and had to flee. We were Huguenots, so early Protestants, had to flee religious persecution and got to Switzerland. And I wanted to look into, I was becoming interested in my family history. And this is around age 30, and that often happens, that the way into history is through a very personal route. So I started looking into it, but I mean, not very much is known about our family. And I thought, well, actually, I'm quite interested in the time and what happened to Huguenots in general. And so I started to create a story that was not specifically about the Chevaliers, but was around the same time period, so that I could explore the stuff that my ancestors might have gone through. And that was sort of the way in. And then I discovered I really liked doing it. I liked writing the historical sections a lot more than the contemporary sections of that book. That was called The Virgin Blue. It was my first novel. And that meant, and after that, I thought, oh, yeah, the history is the thing that works for me. And then I had the idea to write Girl of the Pearl Earring about a Vermeer painting, and that took me even deeper into history, and I haven't really looked back.
Speaking of Girl with a Pearl Earring, that book has taken quite a ride after being published. Literally millions of people have bought the book and read it. It was made into an Oscar-winning movie. When you begin a project like that, I mean, there's no way to know where a book is going to take you, the writer, and us as the reader. But was there anything about that book that gave you a clue that this was going to resonate with so many people?
Absolutely nothing. I really thought that it was going to, sink gently away into the night. I knew that it was a painting that people liked, but I didn't realize how beloved it was and how so many people want to know more about the painting and want to know, uncover the mystery of why she's looking at us like that. And I think that that's the book's great strength, is that it delves into this this particular painting. I think it wouldn't be the same book without a strong painting like that. So, but I, at the time, I had no idea. I just wrote what I wanted to write, and I thought, so it all, it took me, I think it took everybody by surprise, my publishers and definitely me. It's, I'm not sure I've ever recovered it. It's almost 20 years later, so I'm still a bit taken aback, and I still talk about it all the time. People ask me questions about it. I still look at that painting almost every day because it still hangs in my office. And luckily, I'm happy to talk about it because I can imagine, you know, it's like certain song. I think Joni Mitchell said, you know, everybody wants to hear the same song over and over again. Nobody ever asked, she says in this live album, nobody asked Van Gogh to paint Starry Night again, but they asked her to sing Clouds again over and over again. And I feel lucky that, you know, I don't have to write it again, but I can certainly talk about it again, and I'm happy to, because it's, the painting is still a mystery to me. And I think that's the other thing, is that if the book actually answered all the questions about that painting, then nobody would, you know, we wouldn't go on reading it and talking about it and looking at the painting. But actually, the best artworks, the best paintings are the ones where we leave the, you know, we'll look at it and then we leave the room and then we think, I just go back and have another look. And, you know, you just never, it never resolves. And I think that's something to be celebrated. And I feel incredibly lucky to sort of be riding the coattails of that painting.
Well, there's something about a book, a song, a movie that leaves you a little discontent at the end. Maybe it doesn't wrap up perfectly. And there's something to be said for that sense of longing that you're left with, and a visceral experience with it. I know in some things that I've seen with you and read about you, you are a very visceral writer, and your writing process from the types of notebooks that you write in and how you very deliberately choose them, even to, I think I saw one time that you you paint the office that you're writing in to reflect a mood. I think you were working on a William Blake book one time and painted your office yellow to you know, signify the fire. That is very interesting to me, because I think the reason that your writing comes across in that way as a reader, I'm left with that visceral experience, is because in the writing, you are putting that into it. Can you talk a little bit about your writing process and why that physical connection to what you're doing matters so much?
Well, it's interesting because I actually write by hand. So again, it's very physical. I don't type into, well, I write with pen and ink and pen and paper. And then at the end of the day, I type into the computer what I've written. But to me, it's really important, the connection between my hand and my brain seems to be a more organic and stronger one than my connection to through my brain and a screen. And that is, it feels the physical is very important in another way too, that I focus a lot on movement and what people actually do and say, and the descriptions are very much about like the five senses. So it's like what my characters are seeing, what they're smelling, what they're tasting, what they're hearing, what they're touching. I also write scenes. I visualize them like they're a little film in my head, and then I write down what I see. So it's all very direct. I want the reader to feel kind of absorbed into it. I'm not so much a wordsmith as some. It's more like trying to create the whole world around a reader so that they feel that total immersion in it. And I think part of that is by being quite physical about it.
When you write by hand in a notebook and then transfer that to the computer, Do you feel like that writing by hand, physically putting the words on paper in ink, is a different experience than writing on the computer?
Yeah, it is. I write more slowly, and it makes me think more slowly. So I think when I'm writing a sentence, it takes longer to write. It's more laborious writing a word, and so you think about it more. Whereas a computer, you just kind of type it on. I type fast, and it appears, and it looks so good on the screen. It looks like it's typeset already. It's right margin, justified. And unfortunately, I think that makes us incredibly lazy, because a lot of us just, we'll put something up there and then think, oh, yeah, I'll go back and edit it later. But it doesn't feel like it needs editing because it's not messy. Whereas on a page, as you write, you edit. You're crossing things out. You're kind of moving things around, and you can see all of those edits on the written page. Whereas nobody puts track changes on a Word document when they're writing it. It's too hard to see that and understand it. But the when it's written by hand, I it's like a roadmap of what my thought process has been when I've been writing, because I can see the edits, and I'll try something out. Like, I might move a sentence from one place to another, and later when I'm looking it over, I can see that I've moved it, and I think I'm going to move it back. Whereas if you type it, I don't know, it just doesn't have the same effect. And so all of that makes it feel more like it's me, like it's really my brain communicating this, my mind communicating, rather than and I'm in control of it, rather than the computer kind of controlling it for me and setting it up, publishing it already on the screen. And that I found important, although I realize I'm a dying breed. I don't know many writers who do that anymore. Most write directly on the screen, but I think I'm going to be old school that way.
Well, I know a few who write longhand and then transfer it to the computer, and I think you can tell a difference in the prose. I really do. I don't know. I mean, we could argue the esoteric nature of, that writing tools.
How do you think the prose?
I don't know. It seems to be more deliberate. It seems to be more. And I'm thinking of three or four different writers in my head right now, and I don't know. It seems like there's been more care taken. Let me just put it that way.
Yeah. Are there a couple of writers now? I want to ask them if they. I'm thinking of Ann Patchett. I just read her new novel, The Dutch House, and it's so beautifully written. It's like, when you start a book and you realize, oh, I am in the hands of somebody who knows what they're doing, and I can just relax. That I absolutely felt like that with this book, and I wonder if she writes by hand. I'm going to have to find out. I got to go do some research and find out.
I know Neil Gaiman does, and a friend of mine, Richard Gleaves, does as well. There's a different weight to it, almost. I don't know. This esoteric things we could argue all day, but your new book, A Single Thread. One thing that I love about your books, Tracy, is that you introduce us to these big ideas, but we see them through the narrow view of a character, and we get to experience this world and this big idea through a person and through her eyes a lot of times. Tell us about A Single Thread, and what was the big idea that got this story going for you?
I think the big idea was the thought, the notion of a woman on her own finding a community in a cathedral. And most times cathedrals can seem like they're a little bit chilly and off-putting, but actually they're full of communities of people working together to make the place run. And this was the community I discovered was a group of volunteer women who made cushions and kneelers for the choir stalls in the 1930s. And I just thought, I want to see if I take one of the take a woman on her own and put her in this group, what would happen to her, and could she take sustenance from it? And when I started doing research about the time, I found this notion of the label the newspapers at the time called a surplus woman. There were 2 million more women than men after World War I, and the newspapers thought that this was a big problem for society because women were supposed to get married, and what are we going to do with all these women who are not going to be able to marry? And they saw it as a problem that society had to solve. And I thought, well, what if one of those women isn't a problem? What if she solves the problem herself? And does not what people expect her to do, which is to live with her family and look after her older parents. Instead, what if she strikes out on her own and finds her own communities and her own sustenance? So that was how the book came about.
The idea of a cathedral and the community surrounding that is definitely a lost part of our culture, a lost art almost, in a lot of ways. Even in the Deep South where I live, these big places used to be a central place for community. What is it about our society now, do you think that we're missing out on as we move away from these types of places that mean so much in our community?
I think that we're losing out, and I do think that a lot of cathedrals now are trying to find a way to remain relevant. I think we've moved away from organized religion, and people go into a cathedral and worry about, they think, oh, I'm supposed to be having religious thoughts or whatever, and that's why they don't go, because they think this is not for me. And actually, I think cathedrals can be for everyone, and that there's a sense of a place. When I go in, I feel like it's a place that's so much bigger than me that I become quite insignificant in a good way. I feel like I'm knocked off of center stage when I enter a cathedral, and that's a feeling that is one that's healthy for everybody, to see ourselves as one small part of a much larger thing, is really healthy, and. So I hope that people will feel, maybe if they read the book, they'll feel, hey, I could go into one and just look around at the things people have made and maybe discover there are still some communities there of embroiderers, of bell ringers, of flower arrangers, people at Winchester, there's a group at Winchester Cathedral who call themselves the Holy Dusters. And they go around and dust a place. And there's something about dusting a place like that or mopping the floors. You just feel like it's actually a working place, too. It's not just something where you need to be reverential. It's actually, there are plenty of communities there. So maybe that's the way back into them.
I know that when you're working on a lot of the books that you have in the past, you get involved with some of the things that your characters did, like fossil hunting, for instance, or quilting. Was there anything that you did in writing this book that got you closer to Violet?
Yes, I learned to embroider myself. It's now what we'd call needlepoint, and in the book, Violet makes a spectacles case for her mother for her birthday, and she also makes a needle case for her her niece. And I made both of those and still have them and use them. And I made them the colors that the characters would have liked and the pattern and such. And it really helped me. It's much easier to describe something you've actually done rather than trying to imagine it. So in some ways, it's a shortcut. And I also just like making things because it uses a different part of my brain from my writing brain. So it's really pleasurable to make something. So I was very happy to learn how to make that stuff. I didn't go so far as to dress the way Violet dresses and eat what she eats, because that would just be taking it too far. But definitely could do the embroidery. And she also gets to know a man who's a bell ringer, and bell ringing is very important in the cathedral and elsewhere. And I decided to research that, and so I went up and spent a lot of time in the tower there with the bell ringers, watching them ring, and they let me ring a dummy bell so I could figure out. It's very hard to do, so I got a sense of what that felt like as well.
Well, the new book is called A Single Thread. It's available everywhere now in hardback, audiobook, and Kindle edition. Tracy, if people are just learning about you and want to dig into all that you do, is there a place where they can connect with you online?
Yes, I have a website, tchevalier.com, or you can just Google my name and it comes up first. And there's all kinds of information about me, but there's lots about A Single Thread, and you can see photos of the cushions and kneelers and Winchester Cathedral, so you get a better sense of the place.
Excellent. Tracy, I'm a big fan of what you're doing. We're going to send everyone to see you and to pick up a copy of A Single Thread. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you to Tracy Chevalier for being my guest today. Be sure to check out her work and the show notes of this episode. Now stay tuned for a special audiobook clip from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
"I'm melting! I'm melting!"
cried Joey.
"Take the picture already!"
He stood with one arm around the bronze waist of the bewitched tribute statue, Samantha Stevens, riding a broom across a crescent moon. Jason tried in vain to frame the shot without any tourists in it, but that was impossible. From all points of the compass, a merry horde had arrived for Salem's two-day summer psychic fair. All the commuter trains had burst open, like cornucopias filled beyond capacity, spilling endless fruits and nuts onto the red brick sidewalks of Essex Street. A vampiress in lavender shorts and feathered boots sold maple chocolate walnut fudge in front of the Witch City Tattoo Parlor. A near-naked gypsy in purple-green veils danced with a pheasant in her arms around a plug-in Hanukkah menorah. A fat man in a fetching blue jeans dress sold amethyst and citrine charm bracelets in front of Medusa Cafe, but his stand got knocked over by a one-armed crone driving a mobility scooter who sang choo-choo as she passed, her stump on the wheel, her lipstick ghastly, her gnarled right hand raised in trailing plumes of noxious cigarette smoke. Chewbacca leapt out of her way and slapped sparks from his fur. He gave a disgruntled growl before going back to playing Summer Lovin' on his ukulele. The old one-armed dervish drove off, choo-choo, parting a crowd of wanderers, slack-jawed tourists with camera straps tight across their bellies, yellow-vested police on segways, elderly rollerbladers, face-painted infants and harried parents, and college girls. So many hot, hysterical college girls that you'd think somebody had napalmed a sorority house.
"Jason, are you deaf?"
"Sorry." Jason raised the phone and took the shot. Joey inspected the photo and nodded in approval.
"Your turn."
"No, thanks."
"Do it, Shaggy. Don't make me hex you."
Jason gave in and traded places. He put an arm around Samantha's metal back. Her bronze body had flushed in the afternoon sun, warm through his glove, but her eyes were weary. No, downright creepy. And her smile was forced, like a Disneyland princess who'd had her toe stomped.
"Say chowder,"
cried Joey, who'd been practicing his New England accent all morning.
"Come on, man. Say chowder."
"Fine, chowder." Joey got the shot, and Jason surrendered Samantha to a chubby kid wearing a Gandalf beard who climbed up to worship her bronze bosom.